I could sit and listen to this man all day. He has a unique voice, and you have probably heard him and seen him doing many things over the past 40-odd years. My guest is Bill Reiter.
Oh, gee, for a minute I thought you thought I was Jerry Landa. he thinks I'm Jerry Landa.
Jerry's a little smaller than you.
Yeah,
are.
That's true.
We are both big guys.
Yeah, I love Jerry Landa. Jerry Landa is the first guy that I went to a studio. He wasn't my first radio hero. Maybe Wolfman Jack was, but then again, I think maybe Jack Cullen was. Because Cullen, I mean, being into R&B, Cullen played stuff that, you know, turned all us guys in the East End. And I purposefully said, all us guys in the East End, to sort of do an East End voice, you know, mm-hmm. or an East End sentence. But Landa was, he was so receptive, you know, I mean, we went down, I think maybe I went down alone, I'm not too sure. I think I have a feeling there was somebody with me. I wonder if it was Al Foreman. Could have been, you know, the piano player, the singer in town. Al and I were our old pals, and could have been Al and I that went down, knocked on the back door. He's not going to let us in. But Landa was so welcoming and just, well, sit here, guys. Sure, no problem. Sit here. And watched everything and watched Jerry. And wonderful, wonderful guy.
What year would that be? How old were you
1932.
Then?
1932. Well, you know how old Landa is. Yeah. And, you know, Landa's going to be laughing at all of this. So we know that, right? Mm-hmm. We know what a wonderful guy he is. We know he will not be a... But wait a minute, he may phone me, you know. What do you mean, 32? He may have changed. Maybe a grumpy old guy now. I would say that was probably, Mike, it all fades into one clump of memory. But I would say that was probably, I'm going to say 58. I don't know, because I was born in 43. So, and I always have to do this, 43 to 53, I'm 10 years old, I'm not here yet. Came here when I was 11 years old from Montreal. I'm thinking 58, 1958, yeah.
So and Jerry Landa...
probably CJOR.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So Jerry Landa turned you on to the kind of music you like, or did you already know what you
like? Landa was playing stuff that we liked, obviously. But it's just that going to see him... was actually going to see a real disc jockey, a real guy doing the real work, you know, and for him to be so welcoming.
So you got in there, you sat in on his show.
Yeah, just watched and thought, wow, this is something I'd love to do. And then another thing was when I was a kid, everybody said to me, even as a kid, you know, you got a voice. You should be a radio disc jockey. That I heard that from, I don't know,
puberty
15,
onward.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Well, my voice was like that, and then when it changed, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. But the main thrill in radio was the night, because I used to listen, as we all did. Especially my age, and I'm sure you too, at night, listening at, you think of it at 1 o'clock in the morning, but in those days it was probably 11 o'clock at night, and maybe even 10 o'clock, right? Mm-hmm. Mom and Dad are asleep, and you've got the radio beside the bed, and you're just moving the dial just as, and then all of a sudden you hear this voice.
Hi, babe. Hi. You're going to love it to death. Hot baby, Del Rio, Texas. It's a Wolfman Jack.
It's, oh my God, who is this? I've never heard anybody. And for him to say some of the things, and after that, doing that voice, this is when I'm going to take the sip of the coffee that's in front of me that you most graciously have bought me. But to hear him say things like, because he used to get people to write in, right? They send your dollar. And you can send in for the lighter. He used to sell lighters. And he said, you can light anything with this lighter. You can light your cigars, your cigarettes, your bombs. I mean, you know, I never heard anybody say something like that on the radio before. Wolfman Jack. And so Wolfman Jack became the hero of all, you know, I think I may have been, but one of my friends, Trevor Muir, John Katnick, one of those guys is going to say, oh, no, I listened to him first, and then I told you about him. But, of course, in my mind, I was the guy that discovered Wolfman Jack and told all my pals about him. But then whoever discovered him first, it became a thing for everybody then at night to try to dial. And this is when he was in Aqualicuico, Mexico. This is how I remember the pronunciation. Guys like our pal Ted Wendland and John Perkins, they can fill us in exactly where Wolfman Jack was when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. But he used to, Wolfman Jack would drive down, because I read his autobiography about 10 years ago. He would drive down from Del Rio, Texas to do the show in Aqualicuico, Mexico. So that was it was Jerry Landa, but before Jerry Landa, of course, the King, and we know who that was.
Your first opportunity to get on the radio and actually do something was
1967 CKLG FM.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, I was running a record store called Bill and Bob's. Strangely enough, my partner was a guy named Bob.
Gee.
I know.
How did that happen?
I don't know. We thought, what can we name this store, Bob? Well, I don't know, Bill.
Where was the store?
Called Larry's Record Store.
Where was it located?
It was in the Ripley's, believe it or not, narrowest store in the world.
Ah,
the
yes.
Toy building.
In Chinatown.
That's right. It now called the Chow Building. The uncle of a good friend of mine, Buddy Chow, his uncle owns the building now. But it was in Ripley's, believe it or not, is the narrowest store in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we own Bill and Bob's record shop, Bobby Garrison and I. And this young guy came in one day and said, you know, because you sell jazz and rhythm and blues and gospel, that's all you sell, would you like to sponsor me? I'm going to have this new jazz show on CKLG FM. And Bobby and I thought, well, it would be a good way to promote the show, or promote the store, but a good day for us is being able to make enough money to go and have dinner at the Ho-Ho up the street. But he said, well, will you go in and talk to Frank Callahan? I don't think he even gave me a name. You know, he just said, would you go and talk to the program director? So I thought, okay, I'll go in and talk and see, you know. And after an hour of talking to Frank, Frank said to me, well, that fellow is just one of 10 people who we're talking to. But how would you like to do the show?
And I guess you didn't hesitate.
Well, no, because I always wanted to do radio. I wanted to be a disc jockey because I had the voice for it, supposedly. And I had the records, too. You know, I don't know how many albums
Did
I had.
Did you bring your own albums to
well,
do the show?
Well, that was the beauty of it. See, LG Management, I think I've written this down. LG Management, Frank thought it was going to be a blues show. I think if he, I don't know this, you know, and I don't want to, I mean, it's not burning bridges now. I don't think Frank knew the full scope of what I had in mind. You know, I don't think he thought I would play Diana Ross along with Howlin' Wolf. I think that's why they gave the okay, and I think that's, I don't know what he sold it to. Was it a Moffat station?
And
I don't know what he sold it to those powers that be. As. You know, maybe he sold it as a jazz show. Maybe, I don't know. But I know what they, about 15 years later, in talks with Alan Acca, who was the head of sales, wasn't he? And another EastEnder, too, Alan Ack. And talking to Al, I found out that, in fact, what they used Groovin' Blue for was a gauge to see if this San Francisco format called Progressive Rock Radio, Underground Radio, would work in Vancouver. So they saw a perfect chance in using an even more underground, if you will, show that played only black music in Vancouver, for God's sake. If that got any kind of listenership, then an even broader underground format would probably work.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get a listenership, and 6 months later, LGFM went on the air. And luckily, they kept me on, not just doing Saturdays, which I think the show, I think I started in October 67, and then I think in May.
So that was the birth of Groovin' Blue.
And Groovin' Blue, the title of the show, came from a jazz album by Curtis Amy, Curtis Fuller and Curtis Amy on Pacific Jazz Records. So I feel sort of bad about that because I always try to be original. But that title, Groovin' Blue, just sort of summed it up. Because yes, I was playing blues. Yes, I was playing jazz. Yes, I was playing soul, rhythm and blues, gospel. The full spectrum of what I then coined a term, New World African Music.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I thought it encapsulated all of those genres of music.
Were briefly a boss jock on LGAM.
Yeah, it was Bill Ryder, the all-nighter. And I had forgotten about that in a way. Wendland's the guy that always, Ted Wendland, Radio West, he's the guy that, as we know, he's the guy that always brings that up. I always know Ted's around because I hear somebody say, Bill Ryder, the all-nighter, behind me. And I'm doing Wendland's voice. That was pretty good. That sounded mm-hmm. like Ted Wendland.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's Wendland that actually, you know, always reminded me that I used that. I'd sort of forgotten.
And how long did that last?
I was doing that as
well as,
because I started doing Groovin' Blue on LGFM first. And then they asked me, you want to go on AM, you know, and do the all-night show? So what I do is I do Groovin' Blue from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock. Then I'd go and catch a movie, and then I'd come back at midnight and do midnight to 8.
And you'd be honking out the top 40 hits doing
that.
Yeah. So totally different genre of music.
Yeah, Love Puppy. I don't know. There was one thing. They just put a thing up on Radio West, which is one of the first times, if ever, that I heard myself as a boss jock. And the first thing they played, I don't even remember the group. It's like Love Puppy or something. I thought, I've never heard that group before. You know?
It's amazing looking back at some of those charts and some of the songs on them that we have never heard again. So let's move along. And also you went to CKVN after that.
Yeah, but did you know that I was on Bill Bellman's station?
QM?
Yeah. I went in because after I was fired, which is not a bad word in radio, yeah, hello, Doc Harris. I think he holds the record. I don't know. But no, it's just a fact of life. I went to QM, and Bill Bellman and I sat down. And once again, we talked for about an hour. And strangely enough, I think a lot of people would say, we found we had some unbelievably esoteric, similar interests. And one, which was out of the blue, was a love. Oh, Jesus, this sounds strange. Even I've never verbalized this, so I'm trying to get the words together. A love of, there's a genre of music that 99.99999% of the people in the world don't know about, and it's bluesy sax music performed by, at its best, American black jazz saxophonists in Tokyo, playing things like Tokyo No Blues, Shibuya No Blues, and it's almost done in the Georgie Auld style of sort of, and it's almost like the old drinking songs of Japan, but it's American blues guys. And these guys became huge stars in Japan. And Bellman knew about this. Like, I'm a Japanophile. I love Japan. I love things about Japan. And a lot of them are fairly esoteric, like that. And that ties in, of course, with my love of black music. And Bellman knew about this. And so here we are sitting down. I go there to be interviewed about becoming a disc jockey on QM, which is a strange place for me to be at disc. And Bellman and I start talking about Sam the Man Taylor and a couple other guys. And so I got the job. And I worked there for about 2 years until there was that coup, that night coup, when they got rid of Bellman, right? And I say it flippantly because I've never been a part of the establishment. So I say it flippantly, but it must have been quite an intrigue.
What shift were you working while you did that?
I think it was something like 6 to midnight or then. I went to CKVN after that. That was post that strike, I believe, at LG. And so it was all the rabble was there. I include myself in that proudly. And that's the time, and I tell this story, almost each week, there was a different program director. One week, like, Mulligan went to Hawaii. When he came back, John Tanner was the program director. You know, you shouldn't go away.
No.
You won't be the program director when you come back. But I always remember John Tanner. And this isn't telling stories out of school. And hello, John, because I think John tells this proudly now. And as I say, John Tanner, John won't mind this. Because as you get older, and I find this, there are stories you can tell that you don't mind telling because you're older now. And you're not as worried about your career either, too. There's that. And so John, I know, will not mind me. And it's a humorous story, and I think John revels in this now. But I remember, because I was a little naive about the more sophisticated world that John and JB and those guys were in. John was program director. You know, a lofty position in radio stations. This was CKVN. And I came in the back door. I remember you entered the alley at VN because it used to be C-Fun and Kits. What a place for a radio station, Kits, in those days. So I come in. John's walking down the hallway, and he's got a teapot in his hand. Well, that's nothing wrong. You know, I mean, teapot. But the teapot is sort of strange, and the way he's holding it, weird too, like you usually hold a teapot by the handle, but he's sort of cupping the bottom of it. And as he walks towards me, I notice that there's foil on the top of the teapot. You know, and then as he gets closer, I notice there's elastic bands holding the foil in place on top of the opening on the teapot. Then as he gets closer, I notice that the foil has been punctured by tiny holes. Do you understand what the teapot...
I get where you're going here.
What they've made the teapot into?
Yes.
Yeah. And John's the program director. Imagine what the minions are doing, you know. So, I'm sure John, I hope he revels in that story.
Oh, I'm sure he won't mind at all.
No, thank you very much. Now, the other story, and this was really weird because I was so naive, and you may find this strange because I think a lot of people will find it strange about the East End, because the East End is the rough, tough neighborhood, etc., etc. But in reality, the East End was not the place that marijuana, hashish could be found. It was Kits. Kits was where hashish and marijuana,
the hippie center of Vancouver.
If you want to call it that, I will go along with that. The East End was into black music, ironically, of course, jazz, etc., etc. That's where marijuana, you know, found. That's the home of marijuana. But the East End was working class. At that time, no one really knew, although the true East End, which, if you want to call it that, which was Chinatown and that area, yes, a lot of people got involved in heroin. The schools like Britannia and Templeton, marijuana was unknown. So I'm Mr. Naive, I'm working at LGFM. One day in the studio, I notice there's all these boxes of Amex tape boxes, and they're way up high. But I'm quite tall, so I think, I wonder what's in those. Maybe I need one to tape the show. And I think, I'll look and see, and I try to reach one, and I can't, and it falls. And as it falls, I grab it, and it opens up, and all these pieces of paper flutter down over my head. And I think, what the hell is that? Why would someone rip up tiny pieces of paper? What is this? It's blotter. Why would someone rip up tiny pieces of a blotter and put them in a tape box? Well, blotter, of course, is... And I mean, there's tons of people out there now that are laughing. I'm Mr. Naive, a kid. I'm a kid. Blotter is where you put acid onto a blotter and then you drop the blotter, right? Drop the acid. So that's two stories about, you know.
So CKVN.
And those are stories I've never told outside of just telling pals. It was a wonderful time.
CKVN then, how long did you stay there and what was the show that you were doing at that station?
CKVN was the all-nighter again.
Again? And did you get to select, did you get a broader range
no,
of music?
No, but I did.
Sneak in some?
Yeah. And the fun part of it was between J.B. Shane's show and my show, because J.B. went off the air at either 11 or midnight, and when he would stay and our shows would overlap, and so we would do the news together, Michael Spiffy and Tony Gear, two guys, JB and I, who would read the news together. So that was a riot, and that was a lot of fun. Yeah. I recorded a tune that John used to play on a show called Prunes, and it utilized a lot of times on the flip side of Philadelphia International records, 45s. I think they had a subsidiary called Neptune,
mm-hmm.
and they would just put the music track. They wouldn't put a vocal side on the B side.
It was sort of like early karaoke.
Yeah, exactly.
You could sing along with it.
That's
without,
right. Yeah. And so I wrote a tune, because John would always do this thing, Prunes, you know. And so I wrote a tune and then recorded it, and then John would always play it on the show. So there was a lot of interaction. It was a wonderful time. Yeah.
So that ended, and all of a sudden, Big Bill finds himself in television.
Yeah, I wonder, I might have been doing television at the same time, because I did three shows initially. The first one was called A Second Look. The first one was Second Look. The second one was Piffle and Cole. And then the third one was Hey Taxi, all for CBC. The producer was a fellow named Al Vietels, wonderful guy, all with Terry David Mulligan. To show you Terry's go-get-em personality, I was working at Bill and Bob's. So yes, it was before I did radio, I think. Or yes, it was. I'm pretty sure it was. Or no. I was doing Groovin' Blue. That's right. It was LGFM. And I don't know if I was doing LGAM. But the people that owned the building at the time were architects. They had the office upstairs. And they knew that I was a disc jockey. They were doing a film, and they asked me would I do the voiceover for them. I went in late at night to CBC downtown, did the voiceover. The fellow that recorded the voiceover was moonlighting and did it for them for free at CBC. He, in turn, told somebody at CBC when they were auditioning for a new comedy show, you should get this young guy in. When I showed up, all the other actors, I wasn't an actor, but all the other people that showed up who were actors were all the older actors in town. In effect, that's really all there were the older echelon of actors. Now, jumping back, when they phoned me at CKLG to ask me to come in, I hung up the phone. Mulligan walked into the room, the studio, and I said, wow, you know what? They just phoned me to go to CBC to to audition for this television show. Mulligan's first words out of his mouth were, "They didn't fool me." But that's Terry's go-get-it, you know. That Terry takes an opportunity and jumps on it. Terry phoned them. They said, "Sure, come on in and audition." When I went there, Terry was there. At one point they said, we want guys to team up who know each other. The only guy I knew there was Terry. We teamed up. During the reading the script, I ad-libbed something. The cameraman and the floor director laughed. It was the first time the cameraman and the floor director laughed that afternoon. That day or the next day, Bobby Garrison and I, the other owner of Bill and Bob's, were at the Ho Ho. The young guy that was taking care of the store phoned us at the Ho Ho and said, "Hey, CBC just phoned. They said you got the job." I'm getting a shiver just retelling the story.
What type of show was this? Were these comedy shows?
They were like laugh-in. The first
with
two
vignettes.
Were like, kind of like, yes, exactly. Blackouts, that kind of skits, you know. And it was an ensemble, too. Some wonderful actors, Mickey Monsell, Graham Campbell, Alan Anderson, Shirley Milner, some wonderful actors. I think Ted Stitter, just really top-notch actors.
So this also must have sparked your interest in becoming involved in this type of a thing.
Because it was so easy for me. Now, that's something that Mulligan said. And it's something that has stuck with me. You know, it's the kind of thing when someone says something to you and you say, "God, there's a truth there," and it just resonates. Mulligan said to me once, "You know what the problem with you, writer? The problem with you is you never sat in some little town somewhere." He's talking about himself, and he means Saskatchewan when he was a cop, right? "The trouble with you, writer, is you never sat in a little town somewhere and listened to the big station, which is probably Regina or Saskatoon, and longed to be a disc jockey. That's your problem." And I understand what he means, because it all did come so easy.
Well, if you have the talent, it does.
And yeah, I mean, but there is something to say for fighting for it and wanting it so badly, you know.
So a couple of shows there. Then along came probably one of the things that you're best known for, Dr. Bundolo's.
Oh, yeah. Well, that is the joy, and that is the...
That must have been a great project.
Yeah, it was. The king of Dr. Bundolo was a guy called Don Kowalczuk. On a guy called Jason Vanderhill on his site, YouTube site, Biff and Bart Fan YouTube site, he's got a video on there of me accepting the BC Entertainment Hall of Fame thing. And I say about Don that what Don did was he kept Toronto from us. We never knew that Toronto was the ogre there trying to get us to change things. He never let us hear any of the criticisms. He protected us, and that's what a good producer does.
A lot of that was all ad lib.
Oh yeah, a lot of it was ad lib. Well, you've got Groman, for God's sake. Groman and I going nuts together. And then you've got Marla Groper, who's just a wonderful talent. Bill Buck, who's, God could never have given us a better actor straight man. I mean, and who's got a wonderful sense of humor, who knows how to be funny when it demands it, and the perfect straight man.
This was radio and television.
Yeah. The television, once we got to television, we got separated from our writers. We never saw them. That was sad, because...
The collaboration
was gone. Really went. And, unfortunately, Kowalczuk, it was the time when he had to follow his dream to go to L.A., to go to the American Film Academy to study film directing. And because he went to L.A. to study film directing, he left Dr. Bundolo. And when Don Kowalczuk left Dr. Bundolo, Soul was gone. Yeah. And after, was it the first year, it was a 22-show series. Grohman wanted to quit after 11 shows. I just had enough. Like, this is not what I want to do. And I talked him into staying for the 22 shows. But after that first year, we both wanted to go. So, yeah, but it was, you know, because we did it live. Every second Thursday, two shows in front of a UBC audience.
Nothing like flying by the seat of your pants.
No, I mean, we had 700 rabid, they were rabid fans. I run into people, even today, who tell me, I used to go out with buddies, we'd get a case of beer, we'd drive out into a prairie wheat field, and, you know, the show would come on at 7. We'd go out there at 6 o'clock, 6:15, and, you know, we'd wait, and it would be the highlight of our week. Wow, that's fabulous, you know. Yeah, we love doing the show. And we did it for 9, arguably 10 years.
But after that, something else amazing happened on television. You had a show called Zigzag.
Yeah, well, and Zigzag was sort of happening to... Was it happening at the same time as...
But this was supposedly a kid's show, but it was one of those kid's shows that wasn't really for kids, wasn't it?
No, it was a kid's show, but then again, you know, the things that were happening, were really for adults. But we never did anything that kids could get.
Right.
So there was a lot of stuff that kids would enjoy. But then there were...
The parents would get it on a different level.
Yeah, that was fun too. And then at the last year of that show, I was able to get Norm and another actor who I so greatly admire, Nicola Cavendish, to be on the show as regulars. So that was neat. But the great thing about Zigzag, because this is how we make our money, is that show... went into syndication, and I mean, it ran for 8 to 11 years.
And everything lives on the internet still. Well, I mean, if you want to go and look for it, I'm sure it's...
Oh, yeah. Well, like I say, there is that YouTube site, Biff and Bart Fan, and I think it's www.youtube.com/user/Biff and Bart Fan. And you can see tons of Zigzag on there.
Yeah. Then you went back to radio again with Groove and Blue in 1993 at CKST.
That's right. Well, I've done Groove and Blue on, I think, 4 or 5 stations. Anytime I got an opportunity, because Coast was going off the air, I knew that. And so I approached them, you know, to go back and do Groove and Blue. So, yeah, that was neat. So I would phone up people and say, hey, Groove and Blue's back on the air. And what I did was I sold... They allowed me to sell time on the station and then give them a certain percentage, you know. But what I did was I looked for... the opportunities to do Groove and Blue. And at Coast, it was selling time. And then understanding that, I then went to CJVB and did the same.
As the Mole of Soul.
As the Mole of Soul, that's right. And then I went to CHMB, mm-hmm. As DJ Zigzag, right, yeah. But...
always staying true to the music that you loved.
That's right. And utilizing how that came about, the Mole of Soul, was my wife. I had all my 17,000 albums and 6,000 singles and 7,000 CDs upstairs in my house. And we'd built a room upstairs for them. And then my brother-in-law said to my wife, you know, one day, because he's an engineer, he said to my wife, you know, one day, that's going to come down and kill you all, right? You know, thank you, brother-in-law, Ed. And so then she's worried. And she says, I don't think it should be up there. We should have you downstairs in the damp, dank, mole-like basement. So I became the mole of Seoul. So that's how that came about. So I, from Bill Ryder, the all-nighter, with its virile sexual connotations, I became the mole of Seoul.
Well, then the commercial radio thing ended for you, but it certainly didn't end your career. You are probably the most recognized commercial voice in this part of the world. You have that very distinct voice. You're the voice of Harold the Star Projector at the Planetarium, yeah, where John Tanner also works.
Yeah, that's a neat thing.
But you have also done all kinds of film and TV and stage acting.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the roles that you've played and some of the series that you've been in. The Beachcombers.
Oh yeah, Beachcombers, King of Kensington. It starts all to meld together. You know, in the interim, we can't lie to the audience. We can never lie to the audience. David Berner came in, right? And we had to turn off the mic. But we just spent, 20 minutes talking to Berner, and he sapped me. He does that all the time. He sapped our energy. But what else? I did Switchback on CBC. And a ton of shows on CBC, Rennie Samard's show, a thing called Crazy House, Leo and Me, I mean, things that I did one show of, things that I forget, I mean, it's amazing.
But Bill Ryder is still on the air. Bill has a website.
WAGR, and it's WAGRADIO. How people can access it is www.wagradio.blogspot.com.
And you have a new show on there every couple of weeks, I guess.
Yeah, about 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Plus, you have an awful lot of information about the type of music that you play, which is not heard anywhere else that I can find.
Yeah, it seems. Well, it's fairly esoteric because it's like... it's a contemporary show like the original Groove and Blue. If you think you're going to get a soul show, then you become, in effect, that Frank Callahan story that I told you about.
Where you're locked in.
Where Frank maybe thought it was going to be a blues show, but it's not just a soul show. Not just a jazz show.
And you mix different eras as well.
And
you're brand new and...
Because I've lived in different eras. But there's a ton of contemporary stuff. I would say it's 70% contemporary. Yeah. And thanks to a thing called Zip DJ, which is a service that serves DJs all across the world. And... they allow me to record companies to service DJs, and I'm one of the DJs they service. So I get to hear contemporary things before radio stations, before clubs, etc., etc. And I have what I'm amazed by is the number of people in the city now who are being influenced by WAGR radio. A lot of the younger DJs are now listening to my show, and because I believe I've still got an ear for what's good, and I'm pals with these guys, so they'll say to me, "Oh, that's the thing you played, that's fabulous," mm-hmm. I'm playing it now. So.
Does Bill Ryder have a favorite memory from his career?
One thing that always comes to mind was when I was doing Lenny in Of Mice and Men, and that's a very emotional play. There's a part where Lenny, I think, he has this puppy, and I think he's, if I can remember correctly, I think he's, by holding the puppy too tightly, which is how he gets himself into trouble. He's suffocated the puppy, and I think that the line is something like, "Puppy," and it's a theater full of people, right? And it's waiting until the right moment as an actor. And "Puppy, why did you have to go and die?" And then I heard people crying. That's a moment of immense strangeness. My God, that's...
I think we often forget the power that we have when somebody puts a microphone in front of us and we're connected to God knows how many people, or standing on a stage.
And the thing is, when I did of Mice and Men, they didn't mic the stage then. So it was projection. And in a theater of, I'm thinking probably, once again, a theater of about 700 people, maybe not that many, maybe 550, and to be intimate, but project, and to have people cry, that's, you know, so that moment sticks out. Yeah.
There's nothing like making that connection.
I know, it's fabulous, yeah. And that's why stage actors, people that have devoted their life to the stage, often say, you know, there's nothing like, that's the true art form, is acting on stage in front of a live audience, yeah.
Bill Ryder, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Michael.